All right. Thank you, Mr. Golden. Greetings. Good afternoon, everyone. And I will also welcome those of you joining us online. You know, there are a few subjects that are important enough for us as Christians that we will often cover them multiple times over the course of a few years. Someone will give a sermon on faith, prayer, fasting, love, as a few examples. And then a few years later, you'll get another one on those same subjects. Often it will be changed. It might be covered from a different angle, sometimes a different or specific aspect of it, depending on the scriptures we use, or simply covered by different individuals, in which case you always get a different perspective, different point of view. This is good and serves to keep us mindful of the need to continually think about and work on the various Christian traits that are so important for our development in righteousness. Hopefully also develop a better understanding of these things as time goes by. Such is the case with the topic I'll be covering today. It is similar. I had thoughts of whether I should give this after the sermon that Mr. Neff gave a few weeks ago. It was quite similar to his subject of press on. If you'll turn to Hebrews chapter 10. In the sermon that Mr. Sargent gave last week, he actually mentioned this topic twice, as I recall, just briefly. And he actually referred to this particular scripture we're going to read, this particular verse we're going to read, but did not turn to it. But we'll look at it now. Hebrews 10, and I'm just going to read verse 36. The first few words of this verse also serve as the title for our sermon. He says, "For you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise." You have need of endurance. So I'm going to talk about endurance today. To start with, there is an important point I want to get across about the word itself. The original Greek word that is translated as endurance means much more than just what we think of when we hear the word endurance. And I'd like to spend a few minutes on this. I want to consider this important and expressive word taken from the original Greek. I don't know the exact pronunciation. It is spelled H-U-P-O-M-O-N-E with a long vowel symbol over the E. I'll say hupomone. Here's a definition from Thayer's Bible Dictionary. And there are several. One definition there says, in the New Testament, the characteristic of a man who is not swerved from his deliberate purpose and his loyalty to faith and piety, even by the greatest trials and sufferings. Not swerved from his deliberate purpose by even the greatest trials and sufferings. You know, there are times when the word is translated as patience and also perseverance. And as we see here, endurance. Thayer's has another definition of the word that combines all three of those. Definition number three on their list is a patient, enduring, sustaining perseverance. It says a lot more than just any one of those single words on their own. In the King James Version, the original authorized version, it is translated as patience more than anything else. But when the New King James Version was made and other translations started coming out, they realized that the word patience simply does not carry the meaning well enough. And frankly, neither do these other words by themselves. It is a combination of that whole attitude, that whole sense of tenacity, of never giving up and fighting for what we want to do. There are many examples we could look at to see endurance and perseverance in action, both in the Bible and in the world. I'll give a couple of examples from a physical standpoint. You know, we will often hear about the endurance needed to run marathons. One of the things a runner will contend with is something they call hitting the wall. I'm sure most of you have at least heard that expression, are familiar with this. It is described as an absolute awful experience. Your legs feel like there's just no strength left in them. At the same time, it feels like they weigh a ton. You have feelings of exhaustion, both physical and mental, and your brain turns to very negative thoughts or hardly seems to work at all. Now, to combat this, there are exercises, both physical and mental, and nutritional things that runners can do to train the body to deal with it and break through, and the runner can keep going. In fact, my oldest daughter, she runs half marathons several times a year. Actually, she did the Colfax Marathon just last weekend in Denver. She told me she did go through that once, years ago. And then she did the training necessary that allows her to reach her distance goals without having that experience. And if it does happen, it's not nearly as bad as it can be without the proper training, and she's able to get past it. Another example, I also heard a story from a book that was written by a rock climber. I did not read the book myself. I failed to write down the title of it. I know the author's name, last name was Caldwell. He is considered one of the best rock climbers in the world. He took on the challenge of what is considered to be one of the hardest climbs in the world. And this is in Yosemite National Park. It is a free climb of 3,000 feet. And it took him several attempts at it before he succeeded. And with another climber accompanying him, he managed to do this back in 2015. It took 19 days to do it. They actually spent nights suspended in small, lightweight tents that they had carried with them on the face of the rock they were climbing. 18 nights they did this. They spent the day climbing. They arranged to have someone lower food and water down to them, and then sleeping in tents, suspended high above the ground. He wrote about the experience. And the one thing that enabled him to accomplish this was an unrelenting endurance and perseverance. He just refused to give up. He speaks of how difficult this was physically, the damage done to his hands and the pain and soreness, but he fought through it and continued until he reached his goal. He says he could never have accomplished this without the years of experience he had, the training he went through, the proper planning and preparation, but without the drive to push through and persevere, it would not have happened. You know, I remember it was one of the first booklets I read when first coming into the church. It had been published several decades ago. It was called The Seven Laws of Success. Now, it's been many, many years since I had read it, and I remembered very little about the book. So I actually pulled it up online and to review it a little bit as I was putting this together. One thing I do remember, though, and the reason I mention this is for some reason, it was law number 6 that always stood out in my mind. Anytime I thought about this book or things concerning success, I remembered this one particular part of the book. Law number 6 is perseverance. Mr. Armstrong also called it stick-to-itiveness. And the importance he placed on that stuck with me. You know, Paul wrote of these physical analogies to our life and growth and endeavor as Christians in several places. I'll just quote 1 Corinthians 9:25. He said, "And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown." You know, the Bible says a lot about patience, endurance, and perseverance, hupomone. That word, that one word by itself appears 32 times in the New Testament, and there are several variations of it that appear several times besides that. And when we talk about endurance on a spiritual level, what are we talking about? Well, Jesus Christ said, "He that endures to the end will be saved." When you think about that, the more you think about it, the more you realize how important this one trait is. Something we have need of. We're also talking about faith. Being faithful and truly committed to living this way of life. Having love for others. And in every other way, keeping the law of God. Of having an ever-growing relationship with God and His Word. Not allowing anything, any trial in this life, any hardship, any relationships with other people to get in the way of that. And we have been warned it will be difficult in this world to do that, and harder to remain faithful as we get closer to the time of the end. The time of the end. Let's go to Matthew 24. We're familiar with Matthew 24, of course, and the parallel accounts in Mark and Luke. You know, at the beginning of the chapter, Jesus begins going through events that would occur down through time, and these are prophetic warnings of some very serious events that will bring great trouble and punishment on the world as a whole, and also make life difficult for true Christians. These are understatements, of course. You know, there will be religious deception on a large scale, which began, and this has been going on. It began not long after his death and resurrection and has grown greatly for the past 2,000 years. Now, we see and hear reports about church attendance and belief in God being down, and fewer people believing in God than they did years ago. But we know that will change. There will be a great deception that stirs up religious devotion in the years to come. And of course, there have been wars. There are wars going on as we speak. And there will be wars in the future that will be bigger and worse than anything we have seen. There will be persecution of Christians. I believe it won't be confined to quote-unquote true Christians either. My personal belief is that there will be a number of professing Christians from different denominations that will reject the false prophet, and they will be persecuted as well. The Great Tribulation will bring trouble and stress and times of desperation like we've never seen. And because of all of this, he says in verse 12, Matthew 24, verse 12, he says, "And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold." And he immediately follows that with the statement, "But he who endures to the end shall be saved." In other words, those who remain faithful continue to produce the fruit of the Spirit, continue to love others, have a love of the truth, and of this way of life. They are not deterred by all that is going on around them. We must endure. So one has to ask the question then, how do we do that? What does it take to endure, develop that kind of endurance? Because it isn't simply a matter of saying, okay, I just need to hang in there. there is a process. There is a way to develop endurance. We're going to dig into that a bit. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews 12 and verse 1 and 2. Hebrews 12 and verse 1. It says, "Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." And yes, those words, enduring, endured the cross, those are all this same word, hupomone. The cloud of witnesses here is referring to those in the previous chapter, in the stories of faith that are there. We have that as examples. We could read about them and learn from them and be inspired by what they experienced and endured. And when you read through chapter 11, and we're reminded of the stories that are referred to, you quickly realize that most of us have not had to deal with the kinds of trials that they faced. Chapter 11 might be good to read through when we go through difficult trials. It'll help put things in perspective. But God was with them. And we have to know, through study of the scriptures, time spent in prayer, meditation, fasting, we can know for sure that he loves each of you and cares for you as well. Let's take a closer look at one of the things that it says here in Hebrews 12, in verse 1. He says, "Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us." And this precedes what he says about running with endurance. So there seems to be something here that would actually get in the way, that we need to be wary of. Ensnares us. You know, we can become surrounded by it, engulfed in it. Or like Paul says, in 1 Corinthians, it can be like leaven, where just a small amount of it is enough to spread and grow and have a drastic effect on us. One commentary I looked at says it clings to us. I was reminded of what it's like to walk into a spider web. You don't even see it at first. Half the time, you're not even aware of it, unless maybe it comes across your face or your hands or something, and it's sticky. That's the way some sins are. He also said, laying aside every weight. Most of you know I was an electrician, worked on construction sites for many years. When you go by construction sites, you always see guys walking around with tool belts on. For the type of work I did, I seldom had to wear a tool belt, but there were times when I did have to put one on, and I didn't like it. I would have to climb a lot of stairs or go up a ladder or even carry a ladder in addition to these tools. And you walk around like that, and it makes for a long and tiring day. And it's hard to do anything else. It weighs you down. Even something as simple as grocery shopping and trying to get all of it inside, you know, and you know, I have a habit of just putting all the bags on my arms as much as I can carry so I don't have to make so many trips. But it's heavy. You don't want to walk around like that all day. What kind of extra weight are we talking about here? What weighs you down spiritually? And can that affect your ability to endure? What weighs you down? Think about the fact that the days of unleavened bread were less than 2 months ago. How are you doing in overcoming, sticking with those things that you needed or realized the need to overcome, or the things you decided to develop and make stronger? Are we enduring and staying on track with those things and building a closer relationship with God? You know, when you think about this question of things that weigh us down, a lot of things could fall into this category. I'll cover just a couple. What about just the world news and all of the things going on in the world? Do we fret over all of the evil and injustice in the world? Do we get wrapped up in the news, politics? I mean, there is a lot to be upset about. There's a lot of injustice, a lot of sin, a lot of evil, and rightfully so. But do we let it get to the point of weighing us down? Or how about the times when we hear a news story or part of a story, only to find that there is more to the story, and what we heard at first was twisted around and gives a false impression of what actually happened? You know, there's a proverb about that. Proverbs 18:17 says, "The first one to plead his cause seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him." You know, so the idea of this is nothing new. And just overall, in general, how upside down things are in this world, where people call evil good and good evil. You know, are we able to keep those things in perspective? Yes, we sigh and cry over all that is going on, and we go to God with it, but are we able to keep it in perspective, or do we let that weigh us down, get us discouraged, turn away? Another one, sometimes just another quick example, you'll see people get promotions or high-paying jobs that they clearly don't deserve or aren't capable of doing right. And that seems to be the case with a lot of the leaders in the country as well. And we or others we know that are more deserving, more qualified, are passed over. You know, these are the kinds of things that can weigh us down if we let it get to us. And it isn't just in this present time that such things have occurred. This kind of thing has been a part of human history from the beginning. I'd like to turn back to Psalm 73. This is attributed to Asaph, who wrote about such thoughts and feelings a very long time ago. Psalm 73, and I'm going to start in verse 1. He says, "Truly God is good to Israel, to such as are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped." It says, "For I was envious of the boastful when I saw the prosperity of the wicked." He is saying that he was down on the verge of having this affect his faith. He said, "For there are no pangs in their death, but their strength is firm. They are not in trouble as other men, nor are they plagued like other men. Therefore, pride serves as their necklace. Violence covers them like a garment. Their eyes bulge with abundance. They have more than heart could wish. They scoff and speak wickedly concerning oppression. They speak loftily. They set their mouth against the heavens, and their tongue walks through the earth." These people give no regard to God, no regard for the good of others. They seem to get away with it, all the evil that they do and plan. They do whatever they want, and it seems that they continue to prosper for it. Let's continue. It says, "Therefore his people return here, and waters of a full cup are drained by them, and they say, 'How does God know? And is there knowledge in the Most High?' Does God even know or see or is aware of what's going on? Behold, these are the ungodly who are always at ease. They increase in riches. Surely, he bemoans, surely I have cleansed my heart in vain and washed my hands in innocence. For all day long I have been plagued and chastened every morning. If I had said, I will speak thus, behold, I would have been untrue to the generation of your children. When I thought how to understand this, it was too painful for me. He said, I look around and it just doesn't make sense. And looking at life in this world and seeing things like he describes here can be very discouraging. But then we have verse 17 here. He says, until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I understood their end. Surely you have set them in slippery places. You cast them down to destruction. Oh, how they are brought to desolation, as in a moment. They are utterly consumed with terrors. As a dream when one awakes, so, Lord, when you awake, you shall despise their image. You know, Asaph says that in looking at everything going on around him, he almost stumbled. It was a heavy weight. He had almost decided and agreed that God must not care. Sadly, there are some in the church down through the years who have fallen into this trap, that let this kind of weight drag them down, cause them to turn away from the truth. It was things that they had seen in others in the world, in their friends, family. Sometimes they were offended by something they saw or heard at church. Sometimes it's simply a matter of neglect on their part as well, for not putting forth the effort and trying to understand and see these things the way God does. I remember this was quite a few years ago now. I was talking to a man one time that I had known for years but had moved out of the area. He had came to town for a memorial of a church member we were both close to. And in the conversation, at one point, he cursed the ministry, saying he'll never trust another minister after some of the things he had seen. I was taken back by that and thought, how sad that he would take such a position over the actions of just a few individuals. There have been others. Some of you know more stories like this than I do. Sometimes they would say things like, God just doesn't answer my prayers. Or look at how these people live and yet they prosper and I try to do what's right. And look at where it's gotten me. A few have even reached the point where they question the existence of God. That has happened. They start to think, maybe he doesn't exist, or at least not in the way we think or have been told. And if he does exist, he certainly doesn't care about me. This is real. You know, I've heard the stories. I've seen it. I've seen it in myself. I've been there on the edge of that cliff, walking away when the changes began to take place back in 94, 95. And sat at home for a number of years until God, in his mercy, gave me a wake-up call, got my attention, and led me back. Then there are those that suffer through trials that have come upon them through no fault of their own, and they endure, sometimes for years. We know several right here in our congregations, suffering for years with serious health problems. And that can be a discouragement, a weight. Sometimes not just for the person going through it, sometimes it can be a problem or a weight for friends or family members that see this, don't understand why God allows the trials to continue. And the negative thoughts begin to set in like a heavy weight or a snare. Asaph in verse 17 came to his senses based on his understanding of God's nature and will and his relationship with God. He understood, as we should, that there is a bigger picture that we can't see. That in due time, God will have all people give account. Justice will be measured out for each one. It won't happen in the time or in the way that we would like to see, but we can and we need to trust that it will come about. Another weight that can be heavy for us. There are standards in society, acceptable ways to live in this world that are very different from the standards that God has commanded us to live by. There is a degree of that that is attractive. It can look shiny, acceptable. We can start to see that as not being so bad. But it can lead a person away, and it can easily get to a point where we can learn to love the world, the things in this world, things this world has to offer. And eventually that will take the place and become something that we can love more than God. We would never phrase it that way. But if there is anything that gets in the way of worshiping God in the right way, that is basically what's happening. Let's go to 1 John 2. First John 2 in verse 15, a familiar verse. 1 John 2 and verse 15. He says, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him." He's talking about the values, standards, ethics, the morals of society. I think we understand that. Obviously, there are things we can enjoy and partake of in this world, but we do have to be careful. And then John goes on to cover three different areas, and it pretty much covers it all. Verse 16, "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world." I want to look at each of these categories. It will just be a brief commentary on each. There is a lot that could be said about each of these areas. I'll be brief, though, only to show that these are good examples of the kinds of weights that can bear down on us and make it difficult to remain faithful and endure in faith. He says the lust of the flesh. You know, most commentaries and biblical writers will address sexual sins almost exclusively when talking about this particular verse and the lust of the flesh. And undeniably, that is part of what is meant by this, but there is more to it. He is talking in terms of physical gratification, which even includes food and drink. And of course, we are aware of what a huge problem drinking is. Food is as well. But even drinking, you know, it's a serious problem, not just here in our country, but even in underdeveloped countries, developing countries, where you wouldn't think that in a place where the population is really poor, they barely have enough to eat, that there would be problems with drinking, but there are. They manage to find ways. I found out recently how some strong alcoholic beverages can and are made out of very inexpensive ingredients and thus are more easily affordable and available. And so there are a lot of poor countries where alcoholism is a serious problem. Another thing that falls under this category would be drugs. Probably wasn't as big a deal in the days when John wrote this, but nonetheless, we see this as a major problem in our world today. Drugs that are legal, illegal, prescription, chemical. Now, of course, we have a growing problem right here in our state and many other states around the country with marijuana being legalized. You know, there are negative effects of this, and in due time we'll see and hear about the negative consequences of it and learn more about the price that is being paid. At the moment, society seems to be oblivious to it. And by the time we see the true effects of it, I think the damage will already be done. I expect that this would be an easy one for people in the church to avoid, but it can certainly be a problem for our children, grandchildren, or those new to the faith that are just now coming out of the world. This is something that they have to deal with. Let's go to the next category, lust of the eyes. It is easy to see where there could be a crossover or similar to the lust of the flesh. You know, looking at things that create a desire for the flesh. Again, the sexual sins would come into play here and be at the top of the list, and the commentaries point that out. But again, it's much broader than that. It includes the desire for things that we see and would like to have, or that others have, that maybe we are envious of. There's also an aspect of it of wanting to be seen, like to be viewed in a positive way by others, to be thought highly of. It also includes the sin of covetousness. You know, and it's not wrong to want nice things or to improve upon what we have. In fact, it's a good thing. It's good to think about something you might want and plan for it and work towards that. But there is a line that we can cross where it can get into the realm of covetousness. Again, we just have to be careful. Where you feel like you have to have something that maybe you can't reasonably afford, or have something totally unnecessary or impractical just because you want to be able to say you have it and have others see that you have it. And we should always take time to analyze what we're doing and why we're doing it. Why do you want this or that? You know, there are times when you realize the answer to that question will cause you to change your mind. That is if we are being honest with ourselves and trying to do what's right. If we aren't being honest and allow ourselves to give in to those desires, that's a pretty heavy weight that we're bringing on ourselves. And it's one that you won't even realize is wearing you down and making it more difficult to endure to the end. Pride of life. The Greek word here is interesting. The literal translation is arrogant assumption. It says there's a great deal of pride and vanity. It is the man that is vain about his station in life and wants the respect and accolades that go with it. And if he isn't where he wants to be, he makes it sound as if he does. This is a person grasping for position, honor, prestige, or fame. The pride of life. You know, this is probably Satan's main weapon and device. And I'll use the word device since that's what Paul says. We are aware, or we should be aware, of his devices. You know, this was the main reason for his downfall. Pride. And he will use it against us every chance he gets. He tried to use this with Jesus Christ when he was with him to tempt him in the wilderness. With two of the three temptations that are recorded in the Gospels, he begins with these words, "If you are the Son of God," trying to appeal to his pride. But it shows how little he knew about Jesus and how much he underestimated him. And how often do we see this with young children in particular? It continues as they grow, but you know, as soon as they get beyond those infant years and enter those preteen years, you can see the pride in them. And you'll hear things like, "I bet you can't do this," or You're too scared. You won't do it. I dare you. Pride. And then you see them with a cast on their arm, leg, scrapes, bruises, broken windows, a couple of cars that got totaled. Sorry, I'm having flashbacks now. But Satan will use that. You know, we all face this issue. We need to have, we want to have a proper level of humility and to understand it. It is something we should pray for because pride is such an easy trap for us. And how heavy a weight can the pride of life be? This also can create a problem in enduring to the end. There are other things we could consider. Can we get weary of doing good? Paul warns against that. Can that be a weight for us? Sure. Going back to something we touched upon when we were reading through Psalm 73, and we start to feel like God isn't fair. Don't let that happen. Remember how Asaph dealt with those thoughts. Think about and study the promises of God, how much he says he cares for us and is there to protect and provide for us. You know, there are various things in life that can cause us to become bitter. And like so many other problems, it will start small, almost insignificant. And if we're not careful to root it out, to get rid of it, it can become a root and begin to grow. Again, just a couple of things to consider that can weigh us down or become a sin that ensnares us. And if it's allowed to take hold and we don't recognize the danger, then it will get in the way of us being able to endure. Let's go to Romans 5. Romans 5. And verse 3. Romans 5, verse 3. It says, and not only that, breaking into the middle of the thought here, we also glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation produces perseverance. And guess what word that is? As we work with God, being led by his spirit to endure the trials in the right way, it develops in us the ability to further endure. And it becomes a part of our character, as he goes on to say in the next verse. You know, God has put it in man, the spirit in man, to endure and persevere. It's a survival instinct that we all have. Some have it to a much greater degree than others, but it's there. The difference is in having the Spirit of God and having a desire to grow spiritually. Remembering the carnal mind is enmity against God. But having the Spirit of God enables us to have a desire to grow spiritually, to do the things that are right in God's sight, and to keep that up in spite of all the trials we face. Let's go to James chapter 5. James chapter 5 and verse 10. I spoke of reading through the examples of faith in the faith chapter as we go through trials. He brings this out also. Verse 10, my brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Take them as an example of suffering and patience. Same word. Indeed, we count them blessed who endure. It says, you have heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. And one of the things I remember with Job was after the great, great suffering he went through in that first chapter, how he responded. It says he put on tore his robe, shaved his head, fell down and worshiped. Then the last verse we'll turn to is in Philippians 1. You know, Paul describes it, our life as Christians, as a race, a contest, even a war. And we have been called and have agreed to enter into it. And we are encouraged to stay on track in overcoming and drawing closer to God throughout the remainder of our lives. It's not just hanging on and waiting for it to be over. Or like, you know, when a person is sick or injured and we're told to rest and we just have to wait it out as our bodies go through the process of healing and recovering. You know, we don't just sit and wait. That's like the servant in the parable who took the talent of money, the portion of money he was given, and went and buried it. Didn't do anything with it, and then handed it back to his master, who was very disappointed with that servant. We have to do something with this. We don't just sit and wait. It is a war. Just as in war, the end result will mean life or death. And we aren't doing this to just win a race or to have bragging rights about conquering a mountain or even having a successful business or accomplishing some other great task. We have been called to know God, to come out of this world, to be transformed, and to be given the gift of eternal life in his family and kingdom. I'll repeat one of those definitions again. The characteristic of a man who has not swerved from his deliberate purpose and his loyalty to faith by even the greatest trials and sufferings. You know, it is written several times where Jesus said, "He that endures to the end will be saved." And in Hebrews 10, which we read at the beginning, it says, you have need of endurance. It's not an option. But there's good news. Philippians 1 and verse 6. Philippians 1 verse 6. He says, being confident of this very thing, that he who has begun a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. You know, the best part, brethren, the best part, is that we are not alone. We don't do this on our own. Jesus Christ lives in us. As we yield ourselves to him, God the Father will do miracles, give us wisdom, guidance, power, encouragement, those other gifts of the Spirit as we need. They will do their part to help us. It's up to us, in turn, to yield ourselves to him. And then, with all of the trials that we face, we must continue, develop that ability, that willingness, that strength, to willingly, steadfastly, and determined stay the course in faith and endure to the end.